Där träffar show 388. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, we have the fifth Q&A episode of the year on the topic of run training in triathlon, and this one is with scientific triathlon coach David Duche as co-host. David has been on the podcast before, but as a quick introduction for those of you who have not heard him, he's been a coach with Scientific Triathlon for coming up on 3.5 years. He is from Belgium, but he lives in the south of France. And as an athlete, David's mainly doing half and full distance racing. He has done a lot of them over his many years in the sport, including some really mountainous and gnarly long distance races that go beyond what you would get in your typical Ironman. Most listeners have probably already listened to part one of the Run Training Q&A, which was in episode 385 with James Teagle as a co-host. And the reason that we're doing a part two is that we simply got so many questions for that Run Training Q&A that we decided to do a part two so that we could cover all of the questions and not leave anything out. And that's what we're going to do here today with David. But before we get into the Q&A, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products, and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can also book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Indoor Swim Trainer is a unique dryland swim trainer that allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. It is a perfect tool to complement your pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to do very specific power and technique work, including working on your catch and your core activation, and it makes it easier to stay consistent even when you can't go to the pool. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back. And you can get a special bundle including a swim bench and a bunch of Zenate training plans and on-demand workouts on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the Run Training Q&A Part 2 with co-host David Duche. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, David. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back and to help me get through this list of questions. It's a pretty long one, and as listeners will have seen, this is part two. We did part one with James Teagle a few weeks ago. Let's just dive right into the first question, which is from Matthias, who asks, is there any evidence in favor or against streak running in general? For example, is there clear evidence that 5 or 6 running days are more beneficial than 7?
Yeah. I don't think, in fact, that there are that there's really evidence that says, okay, 7 days of running, a streak of 7 days of running is much better than 5 or 6 days. Well, at least I haven't seen any research saying that. Matthias, he's talking about a marathon under 3 hours. So I would also say, if you want to go sub-3, you don't have to run 7 days a week. You can really do good with just 5 days of running. But in terms of evidence, I don't know, Mikael, maybe you have seen evidence about it, but I didn't see anything that says, okay, you need to run 7 days or it's better than for example, 5 to 6 days of running. I do think it is important, though, to know that if you... You know, 7 days of running, it is always running, and it puts a lot of stress on those legs. So don't forget that a recovery day can do really good, staying off the legs. Even if you are 7 days, if you are running for 7 days, and let's say the 7 day is just an easy run or something like I like to call a time on feet run, it gives you stress. It's not like a real recovery run. It gives stress on the legs, so you don't want to get injured by it. And in that perspective, I would say, okay, maybe it's better to do 5 to 6 days of running. of course, as a runner, you need volume. You need good volume, consistent running. Do you need 7 days? I don't think so. It all depends of course, which athlete you are too. But in general, certainly for a sub-3 marathon, I wouldn't go with 7 days of running.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think if you're used to high training volume and training every day, then I would instead maybe go for running 5 days a week and then maybe cycling or swimming 2 days a week, even if your focus is on running. So I think that's better. But I think that's also what Matthias is asking. He's not asking if 7 is better than 5 or 6. He's asking if 5 or 6 is better than 7. So he kind of has that. I interpreted it that way anyway, that he's already thinking in that way. But I don't think there's clear evidence, but I think the thing that exists is when you look at observational studies of elite runners, in some of them you see that depending on which cohort you look at, that they tend to have a rest day. Of course, they run 12 times per week because they run twice a day on 6 days a week. And it's not the same with all elite runners, but a lot of them, I think in East Africa at least, they tend to have one day completely off from running. But anyway, as you say, for a 3-hour marathon, that's a different story, and I think that just coaching wise, from an experiential perspective, I would say that 5 or 6 running days, 6 at most, would be what I would recommend for myself. And his next question is, what are the diminishing returns regarding long runs? If I take 80 kilometers per week of running, if that's my volume, I assume he's saying, is there any evidence suggesting that long runs should be a percentage of that volume, or as long as I can tolerate, or just maximum distance? What's your take on that?
Well, evidence-based, I think James probably also already said something in the first part, but I'm not sure. I don't think there's really like evidence saying, okay, you need to do 30%, for example, of your weekly volume or something. At least for my athletes, I think, yeah, you certainly need to watch out with going longer than 3-hour sessions, just in terms of injury. I hardly ever give 3-hour sessions to my athletes, even if it's let's say you're training for an Ironman or you're training for a marathon. 3-hour sessions, hardly ever. It might be closer to the 230 to 45 hours. I'm always a bit cautious with injury. It may be experience too, but I think it's really important. You shouldn't forget that we are also doing other sessions in the week. The volume, the weekly volume might get up too high if you put in a very, very long session. So I would say after 3 hours, there might be diminishing returns. You're stressing really your body with 3 hours of running, and I would say this is enough. Is this evidence-based? No, it isn't. It's more experience-based. So nothing too long, I would say. What's more important, I think, is really running, consistent frequency of sessions, total weekly, monthly volume. I have seen in literature monthly volume, that it is a strong predictor of your marathon time, in fact. But it was only it was only significant if your long run was longer than 21K and the average run distance of a session was longer than 10K, or at least 10K. Of course, 21K for a long run isn't that long. Let's say if you're a slow runner, it might be a long session, of course. I would go higher than 21K, of course. Nothing longer than 3 hours. And certainly, when I use these sessions, long sessions, closer to competition, I would even get the volume a bit down, but just put in more race-specific intensity, which would be more in the 2:15 to 2:30 sessions. So, it's also how you see it, how you mix it with all the other sessions, of course. You need to look at it over the weekly volume, monthly volume, and the consistent work. But a long run is important, of course.
Yeah, I think there are definitely diminishing returns, but in the question about evidence, no, there's no evidence about this. Is you have to find out what works for you, but I think for a lot of athletes, we talked about that in the episode with James, probably maybe focus too much on their long run. I mean, some things we didn't mention, but I think are very valid things to think about is that you don't need to do a long run every week necessarily. Also, yeah, how long the long run should be. So I don't think it's a, so Matthias poses some options, a percentage of volume or as long as one can tolerate or maximum length. I don't think it's about that. It's more about minimal effective dose. What is the minimum that you can get away with and still perform and achieve your goal? I think that's what it comes down to, because then you can be, as David said, consistent with the rest of your running. So we're recording on the 18th of April. So Boston Marathon was yesterday. I had one athlete running Boston Marathon and did really well. I ran a 2:47, and his longest long run, I'm looking at his training peaks, was 2 hours, 24 minutes. So it's not nowhere. I generally don't go near 3 hours. I would say 2:30 would be kind of the maximum that I go up to, unless it's somebody who is just training to complete rather than compete, so they are a bit slower and they just need to be out for a long time to get to a certain distance. Because when you're training for a marathon, I do think that training for the distance becomes important as much as training for the time. So a slower runner might do a 30 kilometer run or a 32 kilometer run as their longest run, whereas a faster runner might be out there for much shorter time but still get in 36 or 38 kilometers. So yeah, it's about finding what works best for you, but I think it's like a minimal effective dose perspective is what I would keep in mind with the long run. What is the minimum that allows you to achieve your goals? And then the final part of the question, hill reps for VO2 max. How can hill reps be so effective in VO2 max training? Dan Lorang, for example, suggests running 3 times 10 times 30 seconds. To run back is around 1 minute for a 30-second fast uphill, so 1-to-2 ratio. Isn't that too long recovery in order to elicit maximum time at 90% VO2 max? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah. Maybe to answer the first part, how can hill reps be so effective? There have been studies already a while ago that have shown hill reps really have a positive effect on VO2, on economy, speed endurance, a bunch of other stuff. You have so much motor unit recruitment, you engage really a lot of fibers. So if you use hill reps, that's a big part of it too, engaging fibers, having a good technique. Where I want to comment is in fact that if you do 30 seconds on with 1 minute recoveries, I would say maybe the goal of that session is not only your VO2, your aerobic max, it's also about that there's a huge strength part there. And their technique would be also very important, I think, because that will translate on the flat when you want to run fast, for example. If you have 1 minute recoveries, you'll be better recovered than doing, for example, 30-30. So you can start your next rep always with good technique. So, you know, in general, I would say, okay, it's not only, we are not only aiming here on VO2 with 30 seconds and 1 minute recoveries. If we want to reach more time at VO2, yeah, research has shown that it's better to do 30-30s, 30-15s. But of course, I can't talk for Dan Lorang, but I would say he's also focusing here on another goal, and not only VO2 max or maximum time at VO2 max. That's my view on it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Like, if you want to maximize time at VO2 max, then the recoveries should be shorter. So that's not the goal if you jog back down to the hill so that you get that 1-to-2 ratio, which is true. Like that's what it ends up being when you do hill reps. So it's more about, as you say, strength and motor unit recruitment, economy. So maybe you can, so But yeah, you could maybe you can improve your VO2 max even without maximizing your time at VO2 max, and or even if you don't, maybe you improve your speed at VO2 max or just your VO2 max utilization. So I agree, it's not, I don't think that session is necessarily maximizing time at VO2 max or even VO2 max adaptations, but there are other benefits to those hill reps. So yeah, I think. I think hill reps are good. You also need to consider the grade. As I've done some sessions where I used something like a 10-12% hill, and I just found that was too steep, so my legs were burning, but I didn't get my heart rate up and my ventilation up properly because the legs were more so the limiting factor. So you have to think about things like that as well. You could do hill reps on a treadmill or on a long hill so that you don't have to walk all the way back to the start if you want to minimize the recoveries. I think they are good to have in your rotational workouts, but ideally you maybe don't put all your eggs in one basket, so you don't do only track workouts or only hill workouts. You can use a mix of both of them.
Of course. Plus, don't forget that hills also put an enormous stress on tendons. So let's say if you get some more recovery in, yeah, it might be less intensive, well, less aggressive for those tendons too. So might be another thing.
Yeah. Let's try to speed up a little bit because there was one question and we're already almost 15 minutes in. So we let's try to be more concise. The next question is from Scott, who asks, can we run too slow? So is spending more time at the top of zone two more beneficial than low zone two or top of zone one in a five zone system?
Yeah. Well, I'll try to be brief. what is important in this question is we want to stress the body with training. What I think is important in that, we want to stress mitochondria and all let them become more and more efficient and all things. But if we, let's say, I think it's important to stay below your aerobic threshold, below the LT1. So if that means it's a jog, well, you should stay and just jog in zone. If it's a zone one run, okay, let's stay in zone one. Eventually it will go up and you'll be running in zone twos somewhere or higher in zone twos. So can we run too slow? I don't think so. You'll always have an effect. Of course, if you want to have more bang for the buck, you might want to get a bit faster, but try to stay below the aerobic threshold, for example. So then, on the other hand, if you have an athlete with a higher aerobic threshold, I wouldn't recommend always running close to that. For them, they might need to be running a bit slower, which will still have lots of stress on the body. And if you would be running always close to that aerobic threshold, yeah, you might just overstress it with all the other sessions. But can you run too slow? I don't think so. But you might get a bit more, again, bang for the buck when you run a bit faster. But let's say keep it below the aerobic threshold. This is very individual, of course.
Yeah, I think just a couple of quick things to add to that. It depends on the entire picture of your training program. So maybe if you're a low volume athlete, then you can get more bang for your buck, as David says, by spending more time in zone two than in zone one, let's say. But if you're a higher volume, and also if you have quality sessions in there, but if you're a higher volume athlete, if you're a lower volume athlete and especially if you maybe don't have so many quality sessions or either one of them or both of them, then it can make sense maybe to focus more on the zone two, even mid to high zone two, because you have the ability to recover. But if you have a high overall training volume or you have lots of other important harder sessions that you need to do, then I think it's more important that the easy runs are really easy. So you have to look at the entire picture of your training program, and that's it. I don't think you can run too slow as long as you do that. But maybe for some few athletes in those scenarios where they have lower training volumes and maybe not so many other quality workouts for whatever reason, maybe they can get a little bit more bang for their buck by going a bit higher within that aerobic zone. But But I think that's more the icing on the cake. And for most runners, I don't think it's an issue that they're running too slow. The next question is from Lars. This was a long one, so let me try to shorten it a little bit. So this is an interesting one because he writes that my current 5K ability is probably 1910. So I don't think he has actually run a 1910, at least not recently. For long 1 kilometer VO2 max intervals, the target pace is usually given as slightly faster than 5K pace, so 3:48 per kilometer for him. Yet when I run these intervals self-paced to be hard but somewhat even, which I also heard is the best, I end up at slightly less than 3:40 pace with considerable variance between individual days. I once did So I'm pretty sure that I do not underestimate my 5K ability. So can I run all my VO2 max intervals significantly faster than my 5K race pace, or should I intentionally slow down? I think that's a question in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's a bit of maybe a difficult one. I think it's good to use that self-paced. The self-pacing where you see you can run faster. Now, probably the question is that you are running faster than you can do, for example, on a 5K, and you wonder why you can't do that on a 5K. I interpreted it a bit like this. And then I would say, okay, maybe you need to start playing a bit with the sessions and get an extra, like you're doing 4x1K, maybe get an extra interval in and maybe go down on recoveries to 30 to maybe 9 second recoveries and see how you are holding that pace. That, let's say, if you are holding the 3:40s as you are doing with your friend or 3:35s, maybe that says, well, by lowering those recoveries, you're also working that fatigue resistance. And maybe it's a sign that, okay, your 5K could be harder than a 1910, for example. If you want to focus, well, on the sprint triathlon, I think there you need to drop the pace a bit back and focus more on your specific sprint distance pace, because that won't probably be your personal best on a 5K coming off the bike. I don't know if this answers the question.
Yeah, let me just read it again. My question is whether I should intentionally slow down the intervals to be closer to goal pace. I think you nailed it, or I agree with what you said, that self-paced intervals is good rather than having a fixed kind of target. Especially, I think this is an important thing as well. You think that your 5K ability is 1910, but you haven't actually run it. So until you have run it, then it's all a bit speculative anyway. So I think it makes sense to go on self-paced. But even if you had run a 5K, I still think that's fine. But it's about the session design a bit, as David said. I think 4x1 kilometer, that's a bit too short. If you're running the 1 kilometer repeats in under 4 minutes, then you're getting less than 16 minutes of work time for a VO2 session, where you would want to get to, let's say, 20 minutes ideally. So you would probably want to get to 5 kilometers and maybe then start decreasing the recoveries, as David also said, based on or depending on how long your recoveries currently are. So my answer to your question is that you don't need to intentionally slow down to be closer to the goal pace. And there's no rule that your VO2 max intervals have to be your 5K pace or anything like that. So it's more about really kind of my rule of thumb is that you want to go close to as hard as you can for the session, but not quite as hard as you can. You want to have basically one rep left in the tank that you could do if you wanted to for those sessions. I think that's our answer, the best that we can give. And next one, William asks, what are the key differences between run training for runners and run training for triathletes? He has a bunch of sub questions, but let's just start with that general question.
First of all, I think normal run training, you're just running, probably you'll get some more volume in. You are just, you are running and you got some recovery. If you're a triathlete, you need to see it with all the different sports. So you better run a bit less, and of course you'll be biking, which helps your fitness too. So that's already, I think, a big difference in terms of volume, doing a bit less for triathletes, and doing maybe a bit more volume frequency of running for runners. Secondly, depending on the distance you're doing, the intensity might also be totally different, of course.
Let me ask you some of the sub questions that William asks here, and you can just give like a rapid fire answer to each of these. The first one is: are there certain kinds of intervals or workouts that are common in running programs that triathletes should avoid?
I would say, as a runner, you could get in a bit more high intensity stuff in. Where you, as a triathlete, you know, it's a very, of course, running is also a very aerobic sport. But if you're, for example, a 1,000 meter or 3,000 meter runner or 5K runner, you might want to get in a bit more intensity than for a triathlete, where it's really, sub threshold mostly. So, I would say watch out for triathlete, watch out in terms of intensity, where you might want to do a bit more or higher intensity as a normal runner.
And are there some run workouts or interval structures that runners don't typically use that make sense for triathletes?
A brick run? I don't think they will do that. Probably they'll have a bunch of sessions that triathletes do, I would say.
I think maybe one thing that triathletes do that runners don't do so much would be your kind of Ironman pace run. So let's call them your like LT1 runs and so on. I think a lot of runners wouldn't do that. They would kind of be a bit more polarized maybe. But not all of them would be that either. So yeah.
Yeah. Maybe and maybe not, because it's if you're on LT1, it's a, what we talked about, it's a good stressor. So probably in running, you also do those high endurance zone 2 sessions. If you're just a runner, so not sure if that's a big difference between both.
I mean, I think maybe there's a periodization difference. This is at least how I, when I coach running, which I don't do that often, but I have done it, then maybe I would add those kind of high zone 2 workouts in the winter base training when we're not really doing much, if any, intensity, but we're definitely always doing some intensity, but not so much. So then you have more room to recover for a runner that is from those high zone 2 workouts. But then when we get kind of closer to racing, it becomes more easy, or race pace, and race pace for running is higher than race pace for triathlon always, because you're doing it fresh. So in terms of, but triathlon, that's when you start to add those kind of high zone 2 workouts, especially if you're preparing for something like an Ironman or a half Ironman, and that's your race pace, which it is for a lot of people. So I think periodization wise, there's maybe a but also that's just my kind of my how I would coach. So everybody's different there. I think we kind of covered most of the things. I think the main one, as you said, is the intensity. As a triathlete, you're always going to run tired, and you're always basically going to be sub threshold. So your training, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't ever go above threshold. Of course, in training you can do that, but I mean the emphasis on those workouts is significantly less than it would be for a pure runner, definitely. The next question is from Ashley, who writes, let me see here. I noticed the significant trend of most questions in part one revolving around injury and long runs. Why do we all believe running an injury to be a foregone conclusion? Maybe it's just our approach of going big instead of often. What does science/experience say around doing many shorter runs per day while forsaking the longer, except the occasional specificity or race? So that I believe is the question in a nutshell. Well, so we kind of talked about this already, but anything to add there?
Not directly, no. What does the science say?
Science or experience?
I think the question is from, okay, is it better to do more shorter runs for some to stay off injury than always doing those long?
Again, even two runs a day instead of one run a day.
Yeah, okay. I would say I have used this myself two runs on a day, because it could be a good, I think it could be a good sort of a warm up before going longer. You have that rest of course in between, so you could even play a bit with the recoveries in between. But it could warm you up to go longer. If you're an injury-prone athlete, maybe it is it can be an effective way to do that. I don't use it a lot. I think professional runners do use it a lot just to get that volume up. And is there evidence? I don't know. I can't say.
Yeah, I mean, observationally, there is a lot of evidence that top runners are running twice a day, generally speaking.
Yeah, no, but I mean, if it's better to run a...
I don't know. But I think for a runner, it makes a lot of sense to do that. I think in terms of the notion that there was a significant trend of most questions revolving around injury and long runs, I think that's a very good observation, and I agree with it. And I think that we have maybe a tendency to overemphasize and overestimate the long run, but also maybe even long runs in general. And actually, a good demographic to go and look at the training of would be short course triathletes, and we know how great runners they are, and for them, there are many short course triathletes that don't, for them, a 75 minute run is a long run for them. So you don't have to go super long to be a really, really good runner. And then when you get, especially if you're not training for a specific race, and then you can build up the long runs when you're training for a specific race where you have to go long, but you don't necessarily need to do too long runs or too many long runs. So I think there is that. And we also talked in part one about the run walk strategy. And I mentioned that even though it's not something that I have used, I think that it's probably underutilized, especially among injury prone runners, to do like a run walk strategy in their training and in long runs in general. So I think, as a, just an overall take, I do generally agree that kind of more frequency instead of more volume in individual runs, I would agree with that. And then just only when you're getting really specific for racing, you have to really kind of focus on building up the long run, but even then do it sensibly and individually for the durability of the athlete. So then we have a bunch of shoe-related questions. And the first one is from Paul. I'm curious for your running shoe thoughts. Are you using super shoes in races? Who should and how often are you training in them?
For myself, I do use them, but in fact, not that much because they are so expensive and they don't have that much mileage, of course. But are they beneficial? Yes, they certainly are beneficial. I think nowadays you need to run in them because certainly in competitions, I mean, because everyone is running in them. Athletes are running faster with them. So you better have a pair maybe to run also a bit faster. Certainly beneficial. There is some research saying, probably more and more research is done now on the shoes, but there is some research saying that even at low speeds, they are beneficial.
That was a recent podcast episode. I'll put a link to that in the show notes with Dustin Joubert's research.
Okay. It shows that at 10, what I've read, at 10 and 12K an hour, so 940, 8-mile pace, it is beneficial, but it is smaller, of course, than at a faster pace, which is a bit logical too. I think what is something you want to take in mind too is that it can give you a psychological benefit. I've had some short discussions with athletes who have asked me, okay, should I run in them in sessions? Mostly I would say, yeah, do run with them, but do not do every session in them. Because if you then come race days there and you run in them, they have a good psychological benefit. You feel faster. And that might also improve your time on the run, for example, or you just feel good with them. So I think it's something you need to take in mind too. But on the other hand, I would also, this is more experience based from what I've heard from some athletes, but also for myself, watch out with them. They are sometimes pretty unstable. So watch out. They could trigger some injuries due to instability at foot and the ankle level. So I think even there has been done a research. There's no real conclusions there, but on navicular bone stress fractures. Again, this is something I didn't have a stress fracture, but in my first year running with carbon shoes, I had an injury on the navicular bone. So is it related to that? I don't know, but I think it might be.
That was the topic in that same episode with so I'll put everybody who hasn't heard that and are interested in these topics should go and listen to that, which will be a link in the show notes. I think if you want to maximize performance, you should be running in them in races, but of course nobody's going to think less of you if you run 2 minutes slower or faster in a race other than yourself. So it depends on if you're basically just focused on maximum performance or not. But if you are, then yeah, you should be using them in races. And how often do you train in them? I think this is kind of like you said, there are many different things that you could consider there. I think you should do some training in them. Definitely as you get closer to the race, you want to build up a little bit of race pace training with them. But you don't necessarily have to do a lot of training in them. Although I also don't think it's a wrong thing if you want to do all of your fast workouts in them. I've gone both ways. When I first got them, I was so afraid of putting mileage on them that I only used them in one training run, like a really short one before each race. And that was it. And then when I was training for a marathon recently in this winter, I used them for all of my quality workouts. And to be honest, I think both options were good. But the one thing that I liked about using them in all my fast workouts was that it gave me a confidence boost in my training because I was just running slightly quicker in training and it made me feel happy about my training and have belief in my training. So I think that equally to getting a boost on race day, getting a boost in your training can also be very valuable.
Yeah, certainly. I think they are really good for those speed intervals, longer speed intervals. You'll run probably faster with like same power heart rate or something. So then when you run them with normal shoes. So certainly for the interval trainings.
And especially if you're training for something like a marathon, so you're putting in big miles, and then they will help you recover faster from those sessions. So that's something to consider. And I think that's where I would say, if you look at, let's say, professional triathletes and what is best practice among them now, is a lot of them are using the super shoes more and more in their key sessions basically all the time. Not all of them, of course, but a lot of them are doing it just because it makes sure that they can recover for the next one, which usually comes around pretty quickly. And the next question, I don't think we need to answer that one. It's basically, it's the same question almost. Do you recommend using super shoes during fast interval sessions? So, I think, and do they have any And do they have any benefit aside from speed or just training in normal shoes? And there we kind of mentioned the recovery aspect already, that you don't get quite as sore because they have that special foam. Then, there are these questions from Florian are kind of the same. Let me see if there's anything. This one is interesting. How do I choose non-carbon shoes for training so that they are compatible with carbon racing shoes, heel-to-toe drop, etc., or the other way around? Is that something you think about?
Well, heel-to-toe drop, I would say choose a shoe. Let's say choose a carbon shoe, which is in drop more, the same as a normal shoe. If you have an 8mm drop, I would go with the same one. And what I think is important in this question is the stability of the shoe. We all know that, okay, the carbon shoes, they are sometimes less stable. If you are used to running like myself, you need a stable neutral shoe. Then you might, for myself, I looked for one of the more stable carbon shoes, which is not that easy to find, I think. They will always be like a bit of wobbly, of course. But I would say in general, try to mimic a bit the same thing as in your normal running shoes. That's what I should do.
Yeah, I think this is not an answer to Florian's question at all. But what you mentioned there about the stability is quite interesting because quite a bit of my running here, I end up going over segments of cobblestones, and both in training but also in some races. And actually, which shoes I choose depend a bit on whether I have cobblestones or not. Because on cobblestones, I find that the more wobbly Nike Alphaflies, for example, are not. And especially the before they were disallowed, the Adidas Prime X, they were even more wobbly, I found. So yeah, I didn't really like them at all for anything other than running in a straight line on asphalt. but the shoes that I do like for twisty turny courses and uneven ground like cobblestones, etc., are the Asics Metaspeed shoes, because they feel more like a traditional racing flat. They're really good in that sense. They are not wobbly at all. They are just very, very stable. So that's a good one to think about as an option, depending on what your races are like and your training terrain is like. Then the final question here on shoes is from John. How much care is needed in ensuring that the body is able to withstand the additional stabilization demands of super shoes in a long race, where every step creates much more wobble than with traditional shoes, and thus cramping late in the race can easily occur? Have you found this to be a problem, and how can one mitigate against this?
The cramping part, I'm not sure if that will be really a consequence of the wobbling of the shoe, but probably strength work comes handy here to mitigate against this. Work on foot, ankle, lower leg strength and mobility. Then I would think at plyometrics, using a Bosu ball, mimicking like unstable undergrounds and doing exercises on them, the ankles become used to this and become stronger. And otherwise, maybe again, the stable shoe, search for a stable shoe.
I haven't found this to be a problem, but I agree. Lower leg and foot and ankle stability and strength work, that would be what I would recommend, basically. And as we said, training in the shoes as well, to some extent. Then the next set of questions is about strength training. And the first one is, again, from John. What are the two must-do strength and conditioning exercises you have found to be the best for improving running economy, building resilience, and preventing injuries?
Two exercises. There are a lot more exercises. It's difficult to say just two really good exercises. I would more split it up in working firstly on the hip and core stability, certainly the hips. It's important, and the muscles around it. And then, secondly, I would say, okay, exercise with the focus on the lower leg, ankles, and feet, as they can trigger also issues higher up the chain. So in terms of exercises, for myself, for that hip stability, I would think, well, and for my athletes, I would think certainly bridges, lots of bridges, getting a more posterior pelvic twist, in fact, which can, because it can avoid like overdoing certain muscle groups, not being a quad dependent runner, but using your glutes and running from those hips. So I think in terms of exercises, then I would think, yeah, some bridges, but with weights, without weights, doing them on a Swiss ball. For the lower legs, of course, against plyometrics. Plyometrics, but you can also, they will focus on ankles, but they will also focus on strengthening higher up the chain, like doing jump squats where you focus on those bigger muscle groups. So plenty of exercises, not just two. But if we need to mention two, certainly the bridges for me would be part of them. Just because of that hip angle. I think it's important, the hip angle. Again, it's a lot experience-based, but it can avoid issues, knee issues, tendons around the knees that are overused. So,
As you say, there's a lot of exercises, but I think that's the challenge here for us to pick two. I like bridges as a suggestion. For my two, I'm going to pick, well, the first one I'm going to pick is going to be an injury prevention exercise. And I think each person should pick based on what their weaknesses are. But if I'm picking for myself in this example, I would pick a hamstring exercise. So I would pick either Nordic hamstring curls or deadlift. Let's say I pick a deadlift, actually. But either one of them, and that's working on my weakness on running in terms of injury, which tends to be the hamstrings if I don't strengthen them. And then the other one I would do would be a single leg exercise, just focused on more on the performance side of things. So that could be a step up or a split squat. I'm gonna pick the step up. Actually, I've found that maybe that some athletes struggle a little bit with the split squat, getting some knee pain and things. And the step up, I think, is a bit more gentle on the body. And actually, it also has the additional advantage that you can actually practice a proper push off the box. So it's even more similar to an actual running stride. Step up and deadlift would be my two.
I also think of lunges. They are also very...
Yeah, they are. In that same group, definitely, with single leg, kind of quad dominant. And then the next question is from Michelle. Any advice on how to keep tendons strong? Plyometrics, heavy strength training, hill work? What do you think?
Yeah. An important one is not overdo it. Which is, of course, difficult to know sometimes. Am I running too much? Or going progressively up, building your volume up, your frequency up, is very important, and give it time. That's already a way to strengthen and avoid issues around the tendons. Again, we talked about it, a good technique while running. If you have issues with tendons, it's always an overuse of them. So you need to search, okay, why am I overusing them? Which can be very technique related. And in that perspective, not only weights and exercises will help, but I think what's also very important is being aware of your technique while running. You can do as many exercises as you wish, but if your technique isn't good when running, yeah, you still might get injured in those tendons. So, think of a good technique while running. How to keep them, well, to get them strong, I would say certainly on the level of the Achilles tendon, eccentric work, like just simple step downs, really good to strengthen and lengthen them without and with weights. And in general, of course, strengthening the tendons is doing certain strength exercises in general. So, that's important. Probably something not a lot of people do, but maybe a barefoot warm-up or a cool-down, or just at home barefoot walking, because it strengthens those small muscles and tendons of the foot and the ankle. Running on trails, of course, watch out, you do not sprain your ankle, but running on trails, uneven ground, is something very effective to strengthen the lower leg, in fact. Hill work for sure, but it also puts a big amount of stress on tendons, so watch out with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is, we talked about this quite a bit in part one, but it's mostly about progressing slowly, because as you say, it's an overused thing. Tendons are slow to adapt. It's like muscles can adapt quickly, your cardiovascular system can adapt very quickly, your tendons and ligaments, they adapt slowly, your bones adapt even more slowly. So you have to basically, if you're a new runner or a new athlete off the couch and you're starting a training program, your cardiovascular system will start to adapt really, really quickly, and you will feel and get fitter within a couple of weeks. You will feel a significant difference already, but your tendons won't have adapted at all at that point yet, or very little at least. So that's the thing to always keep in mind, that different systems of the body adapt at different rates, and that's why with running especially we have to be so careful, because it puts a lot of stress on the tendons and the bones, and they don't adapt as quickly as the muscles do or as the cardiovascular system does. So I think the main thing is not so much about, the tendons will adapt, but they will adapt slowly. So it's about how quickly you progress, and it's not doing anything stupid. It's about how slowly you progress. And then, of course, I think you should do strength training, and there are many things that you could do, like running on trails and things like that, as David said, hills. But at the end of the day, I think 90% of the question, what the question wants to get to, is how do you not get injured? How do you not get tendon injuries? And I still think that it's 90% of that comes down to not necessarily actively strengthening the tendons, but applying your progression very gradually, so gradually that you don't run into issues more so than anything. And then we have a bunch of questions on running form and biomechanics. This one is from Paul. I've heard you say that you don't believe in analyzing running form or trying to shift running form. If that's the case, what is the pathway to avoiding injury and improving economy over time? So I guess he addresses that question to me, so I can go first on this one. I think it's, I'll caveat this by saying that, of course, there are some things that are very clearly, some runners need to change some things about their running, but it's more about, let's say, at least moderately experienced runners that have that already have a decent base level of fitness, and they have achieved a certain level of running, and their bodies have adapted to how they're running in terms of running form, and there are no obvious glaring mistakes in how they run, like completely overstriding or doing something glaringly obvious that, okay, this is something to correct. So it's not that I say that you should never change anything. It's more that for a lot of runners of the demographic that tend to listen to this podcast, then, well, of course, there are athletes of all different levels, but a lot of athletes here are already have quite a bit of experience. And I think for a lot of you guys, it doesn't necessarily make sense to think too much about changing your analyzing your running form, because even if you can see a mistake, you probably cannot, or not see a mistake, but see something that maybe you could do better, whether it's a greater hip extension or whatever it might be. The issue might not be, or you cannot necessarily just change that, but it will not actively anyway, because you're limited by hip mobility. So I think the body will adapt, and that's why I think that doing strength training is really good, and also some form of mobility, which can be done as part of the strength training as well, to give the body the maximum chance to find its optimal running style. So you basically give the body the tools, and then it will adapt to converge towards something that works for the individual. And so the pathway to avoiding injury has, in my opinion, there are some athletes that, yeah, if I see them running with overstriding, I would try to correct that, of course. But so I'm not saying that it's never the case, but it's, yeah, in a large group of runners to whom usually services like running gait analysis are marketed, for a large group of runners, I don't think that those services are really useful.
What I could add is, if you want to avoid injury and improve economy, you might want to get your frequency of running up. Maybe this is something we already talked about, for example, 2 runs in a day or something. But if you are running 3 times a week, well, maybe put in, if you have time, a 4th run, because it's about adaptation, doing something repetitive, the body gets used to it. So that might, well, I certainly think it will improve your economy just by running more. Of course, watch out with it. Again, progressively. So that might be, yeah, that's my answer on improving economy. I think you already said it, Mikhail, the body is adapted to a certain run for. So watch out with like changing things excessively. Even if you really know, okay, I need to do that certain thing different. Do it really slowly. And if it's a huge manipulation of the body, watch out with it, because the body can react in a different way. And if you have been running for 15 years in a certain way and then changing too much, you might get injured. While your aim was to run more economically. But it's just how the body works. It's not adapted to something. It doesn't know what it is. So watch out with excessively changing things. So work with small difference.
Yeah, 100%. Agree with all of that. This one, I'll let you open this can of worms. What are the optimal biomechanics for running, referring particularly to ground strike, ideal knee bend, etc.?
Well, I think you already mentioned one as overstriding. Avoid a too low stride rate, for example. Avoid what's called breaking. So let's say you land on your foot, but your foot is very far, in front of your body, is too far in front of your body. That's also something I think you should avoid. So that means you should land more in the central of your body, of your mass. Does that mean? Well, there's also a part of the question, okay, where does the foot needs to land on the ground? Does that mean heel, midfoot, forefoot? I would say I've seen heel strikers, they can also run pretty fast. As long as it's in the center of your body, it's good. So, well, I would assume it's okay. So I would avoid breaking. So that foot should be more centered and not too far in front. So that's an important one. Also, avoid having too much rotation. A lot of runners, sometimes including myself, in fact, I see this going too much left, right. This is like a sort of waste of energy. You need to have a forward movement. So also something you could focus on by. An important thing here is probably the hip stability. That really helps you have that forward velocity. Those are some of the optimal biomechanics, I think. Are there other ones to add? Yeah, I forgot one, I think. Mohammed is talking about the ideal knee bend. I would also say, okay, don't run with a big angle. Let's say you need some stiffness in that leg, so the angle shouldn't be too small. well, a smaller angle. I mean, a smaller angle is better. Don't run as you are sitting, for example, on a chair. That would be a bit too hard on the quadriceps. But really, okay, have that upright position, a bit more stiffness in the lower leg, or in the leg. So those are for me some of the points to have optimal biomechanic in running.
Yeah, I agree with those, but I think all of those points are more what are some mistakes to avoid. So then within that, there are still, I think if you're asking for what is optimal, I don't think we know. I don't know that it exists. Maybe it exists for each individual. But one, and I'm not an expert in this either, so to be honest, I don't feel that I can really properly answer the question. But one person to follow, and he has been on the podcast before, so, and I think we talked about this topic, is Max Paquette. He's a biomechanist and researcher at, I think, in Tennessee, at one of the universities there. So he's really good. Follow him on Twitter and listen to his episode on the podcast, and he talks about some of the things. But last I checked the research on biomechanics, it's quite inconclusive. There are always different findings, but it really depends on how you define the study. And it seems like there's not a whole lot of super clear evidence, probably because it's different for different individuals, even different at different speeds. So maybe even different for a triathlete versus a runner, because for a triathlete, you have been spending a lot of time in the TT position usually before you get off the bike and run. So for me, it comes down to, again, trying to give the body tools. So giving it a certain base level of strength and mobility, and then it will adapt over time. But as David said, if you can run more frequently, then it will adapt better. And that's what I would do. But again, there are definitely mistakes that you can correct. But what is optimal? I think that's almost an impossible question, at least at this point in time, to answer, at least for me. Next question. Van asks, is it best to run with the form that feels natural, even if not pretty? I am a good runner and have a good run off the bike, but one arm swings out way more than the other. I can run with better, efficient, seemingly efficient form, I guess, but it is slower than running naturally.
Yeah, I would say if your natural run is with a swinging arm and you are going fast, I would say don't mind about something else. That's okay. Don't try, of course, a swinging arm might get you over-rotate a bit in the upper body. So I would say, okay, try to avoid this. But it seems that you're running faster than when you try to run more efficient. At least of what you think is more efficient. But I would say keep it as it is. You run well off the bike. Why change it? If you know that maybe that more efficient form will go slower, and that's not what you want. It comes down to speed eventually. So,
prettier is not the same as more efficient. I think is the the conclusion here. You know who else ran with one arm swinging out more than the other? Haile Gebrselassie. So okay. I think if it's good enough for him, it's probably good enough for Van. No offense meant, of course, Van, who is, I'm sure, is a very good runner. There seems to be a general agreement on some elements of technique, like keeping a relaxed, upright body, increased cadence, being more important than greater stride length, and landing under your center of mass. Beyond that, there are various differences in technique and or cues used by coaches. How far do you go in modifying an athlete's run technique? Do you have a preferred method, and where do you draw the line? This one is from John.
For myself, I don't really modify an athlete's. We've already talked about it. It's very individual. I wouldn't change too much. In a lot of cases, you even don't really know, okay, how is your athlete's technique of running, unless you have some video footage or you saw him running. Still, I wouldn't change too much. Again, we talked about it. It's something you've been running for a long time like that. So don't try to change it excessively. Things, of course, you can use are like strides where you ask to focus on a certain upright technique, a good stride rate. You can work with hill strides, hill sprints. But I'm not really, trying to really change an athlete's run technique, in fact. I don't know for you, Mikael.
No, same. Yeah, again, it comes back to what I said before. I like to try to give the body tools by strength training and mobility, and then let the body take care of the rest, really. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. But I mean, I agree with those things. Relaxed, upright body. Cadence is very individual, so there's no one cadence. Some athletes should run at 170 and some should run at 190. But I think John's point here is that rather than overstriding, you should increase your cadence. So I agree with that. And then he also says landing under central mass, which you pointed out before, David. So yeah, I think those are all good basic points. And if you do all of those, then you're probably doing fairly well. I think on the topic of the relaxed upright body, some athletes could benefit from focusing a bit on their breathing patterns, because some athletes get a little bit of an erratic breathing pattern when they're running without even thinking about it. So that's something that you could think of, and that could make you more relaxed and potentially more efficient. So yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, what I do like to ask if I talk about technique of my athletes, I do like to ask them when they do a hill stride, for example, or just a normal stride, it's really work from the hips and glutes. I don't know what's your opinion on it, but for me, I think it's really important to get a stability in that region. And you get much more power out of it, in fact. You feel it too when you do a hill stride with like a bit of a better technique, let's say, the feet a bit wider, really on level of the hips, you also feel that you are more powerful than when you would, for example, be running with the feet very close to each other. Then you have more like the hips going up and down and up and down. That's not really what you want. You want them to be like more horizontal and going forward. And so I think for me, hip stability is really an important one in run technique.
I agree with that. But I think a lot of that, of course, awareness during the running is really important there, but it's also about just making sure that you have the hip strength and stability when you're doing exercises like bridges and so on that you mentioned. Then that will be a whole lot easier when you're running, and in many cases it will be automatic. And I had something else that I was thinking of. Oh yeah, the one thing that I would say as well is that it's actually, I have a feeling, I'm not very super confident in this, but I have a feeling that athletes' use of quads versus glutes and hamstrings differs quite a bit on the bike in a triathlon, depending on their bike fit and their bike position. So some might be really quad dominant and some might be much more loading their glutes and their hamstrings. Of course, there's always an element of quads in there, but relative to others. And I think that might also, especially in a longer race where you really can fatigue those muscle groups, it could really impact what is the best way to run for each individual in a triathlon. So that's where I think we talked about brick runs a bit in part one. And I think this is another example of why brick runs are useful, to actually just focus on being aware on your fatigue levels in different muscle groups when you're running off the bike, and then maybe trying to focus on using less fatigued muscle groups a bit more. So it might be that for some athletes, a bit more quad dominance in running can be useful in triathlon, and for others, a more glute dominant and hamstring dominant, depending on even your bike position and and fatigue resistance in those different muscle groups.
Yeah, I agree. But I do think that it's important to spread out, in fact, to spread out over different muscle groups to avoid like overusing a certain muscle group for fatigue reasons, but also for injury reasons.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that's it in terms of, well, there is one more actually. I'll just answer that quickly. This one is from Everett. I've been doing your pre-run mobility routine diligently for several years now, and I love it. I'm wondering if you have any updates for it, such as a jump rope or mobility board. So no, I don't have any updates. The pre-run mobility, I don't even have a link to it at the moment. I kind of lost it in my cleaning up on my Google Drive, but it probably still maybe exists somewhere, or Everett has downloaded it when I had it out many years ago. It was just a few basically dynamic movements to wake up different muscle groups for running, and I think it's still a good routine, so I would definitely encourage you to keep using it if it has been working well for you. But I don't have any updates to it, so no, that's the answer to the question. But all right, thank you so much, David, for helping me with these questions, and we'll do it again another time.
Okay, thanks. See you.
I hope that you enjoyed this Q&A. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and I do have a number of links in them as well. I mentioned the episodes that I've done with Dustin Joubert and Amol Saxena, Doctors Dustin Joubert and Amol Saxena, I should say. Dustin Joubert has been in two episodes, actually. The first one on the original Super Shoe study that he conducted and his colleagues, and the second one on the follow-up in slower runners. And Amol Saxena talked about the potential for navicular bone stress injuries when transitioning to Super Shoes. Then I mentioned Max Paquette as somebody that I trust for biomechanics information, and also Bobby McGee. They have both been on the podcast before, so I have linked to those episodes. And actually, I just saw this morning, I'm recording this the day after we recorded the actual Q&A, a very recent study on increased oxygen uptake in runners when they were doing high intensity intervals uphill versus on flat ground or flat treadmill, I should say. So that was related to one of the questions that we had. But then, of course, the thing is that they did the same protocol, which was 5 minutes on, 90 seconds off at high intensity, so faster than threshold or higher intensity than threshold. So basically, on that topic, if you can do the same workout running uphill as running on flat ground, then you can potentially have a higher time near VO2 max. That's what this study showed, and I have seen other studies in the past showing the same thing. The issue is, if you're doing it outdoors and you don't have a very long hill where you can just stand still and keep running up, then your recovery times will be longer. So of course, when the studies compare these things, they compare it with the same recovery time, and they do it on the treadmill typically. But it's an interesting study to look into, and maybe if you are of the optimization mindset, something to consider to do some hill repeats on the treadmill actually, and do high intensity intervals that way. Next Monday, I interview Paul Newsome, who is a triathlon swim coach that many of you will know either from his previous appearance on That Triathlon Show or just in general from being the co-founder of Swim Smooth. He will be back and we will have a good discussion on swim training and swimming. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, then consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or a training plan. We have options for athletes of all different levels, for different budgets, and no matter the size of your goals. A few points to highlight that reduce the barrier to get started is that we have no minimum commitment term nor startup fee for coaching. And for training plans, we have a 100% satisfaction guarantee for plans purchased on our website, and an exchange guarantee so that you can exchange your plan for another plan if you purchase it through Training Peaks. We also have consultation and customized plan options, so you can find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS23 at checkout for 15% off your first order. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate Swim Trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and swim training consistency. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get the special bundle, including the swim trainer and a number of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.